The Protect Your Neck Podcast, UFC Kansas City Recap. Don't let the ratings fool you, kids. It was a hell of a show.
Hot air hangs like a dead man from a white oak tree. People sitting on porches thinking how things used to be. Dark night. It's a dark night. Dark.
What is up, my friends? This is the Protect Your Neck Podcast, and I am your host, Dan Tom, analyst and writer with FlowCombat.com. Today, we are going to be recapping UFC on Fox 24, UFC Kansas City, that happened last night. I know we usually do the after-party edition, but and usually if it's just me, and I don't let that stop me. You know, Dan Tom, doesn't let him stop him from having a few and doing an after-party edition. But honestly, I wasn't feeling too well. I ate after the main card, and just wasn't feeling too hot. And I wanted to rewatch some stuff because there was just so much good stuff to unpack. I didn't want to miss any, and much less give a subpar performance. So I said, you know what? I'll wait till the next day, get some good sleep in because I haven't had any in a minute, you know. And I'll feel much better, which I do, thankfully. And we'll unpack it properly because don't let the ratings fool you. This was an awesome show, UFC Kansas City, from top to bottom. And speaking of top to bottom, usually I work from bottom to top, pretty diligent about that. But for this one, I'm going to go top to bottom. I don't know if I'll do this for all the recaps or whatever. I just really wanted to get to the main event first. And we'll work all the way down to the curtain jerker. So let's just start from the top. But before I do, just want to give a quick shout out to Cage Siders for having me on this week for, you know, a prediction spot. Angelo Reyes and At The War Weekly, Jeremy Long. You guys are great. Thanks. Way too kind on the social media and the props. Hopefully was helpful to your audience as well as my audience, obviously, the one I'm speaking to. Hopefully the analysis helps you as well because it was a good night. It was a positive night. Despite... I think all the props hit, but we went, you know, 2 out of 3 for the key parlays. But I'll be honest, personally, I kind of spread it around, so it didn't hurt me too bad. The fact that Jeremy Stevens, which we'll get to, was the missing parlay piece for that. But if you took any of the other recommended parlay pieces, you did well as they come through, and we'll touch on them as well. But we're gonna start at the top. It was not a parlay piece because the line was way out of reach, as it is for a DJ fight. But what was surprisingly within reach was plus 100, which eventually got up to plus 162 for Demetrius Johnson inside the distance. Now, I get it, flyweights and, you know, even a more recent of DJ's trends fights, you know, went to decision, I guess. So you could have looked at that and like, oh, okay, I don't feel comfortable laying that. But at the... You know, and I hate using the word value because it's either there or it's not there, you know, as far as the analysis goes, at least, you know, for me. But there was, yes, there was value for plus money on any angle for, you know, what I feel is the best pound-for-pound fighter in the sport. And so the inside of the distance cashed, and you know, with Wilson Hayes being dropped in 4 of his last 7, like I said, and that's not including his last 2 fights where he was visibly stunned. I really liked DJ's chances of finding the finish there. The right hand was there like I thought. The pocket improvements, you know, I was just talking to someone on Twitter, and I'll pull them up to try to give them the shout. But yeah, they're saying, we're, you know, because kind of the hot topic today, Sunday, everybody's sitting around, you know, the water cooler, the MMA water cooler, and we're discussing who's going to beat DJ, how good is he, and, you know, who's the next guy if we had to say, and I weighed in on it, although I usually don't weigh in on stuff like that, but, you know, it's piqued my curiosity as well, you know, and, I essentially said, you know, my old dark horses of the division were Smolka and, Scoggins, for obvious reasons of their trajectory. You know, I no longer hold them in that regard, though I do still obviously like them as fighters. But I think Bibulotov is a guy that kind of has the best chance when you look at prototypically, but he's going to need time to develop, and as well as to just kind of sharpen up his top game and top control, because essentially that's what I think it comes down to. It's just, it's like Dominic Cruz, you're going to need somebody who has a transitionary game to be able to get the takedown in the first place, and then also have the control game to hold him down, because we can get into the techniques and dive into how good DJ is, and believe me, I'm the kind of guy that wouldn't mind doing that. But it comes down to size. I mean, when you get a scrambly guy that's more technical, are you going to really try to out-technic him at every angle and find that specific angle where he's weak, looking for that proverbial needle in the haystack? I mean, you can, and that's eventually what will shake out with the natural kind of progression of the craziness of this game. But, you know, if we're looking for an on-paper path to victory, something that's tangible, realistic, it's just size. You got to get on top of him and hope you can eke out slash steal 2 to 3 out of the 5 rounds. I think if someone upsets DJ, it's going to be a very boring performance, but impressive in the fact that, you know, even that in itself is impressive. Good luck in doing that, at least any flyweight. But yeah, it's really tough. But let me see who it is. Joshua Yandel, at Josh Yandel, was kind of saying that, you know, comparison to John Bone Jones, how they're just so dominant in clinch and at range, and it's so true, and DJ definitely has the connective pieces, but, you know, whether anybody can, you know, criticize DJ inside the pocket or not, I mean, at that point, you're nitpicking, admittedly, obviously, and I'm not condemning that argument based on that. I mean, you kind of got to nitpick when you're talking about guys, he's great, but in this fight in particular, DJ showed improvements in the pocket, and you're like, oh, wow, well, Wilson Hayes is not the best striker. He didn't have any stoppages of strikes. Yes, granted, but Wilson Hayes, you know, he's a very competent striker, and this was honestly Wilson Hayes' best performance in just rewatching this fight. As far as Wilson Hayes' smoothness, the way he was kind of setting up and loading up those angles, not just moving his head left to the right to look good, but what he was, you know, trying to set up, obviously, Demetrius Johnson was never there for Hayes to pull the trigger effectively, or when he tried to, he just wasn't there to be hit, so it just made Hayes look, you know, ineffective, which ultimately what he was, but that doesn't mean that Hayes wasn't putting on the performance of his career, which is kind of crazy to think about in retrospect. And that being said, DJ was able to find that weak angle, the southpaw stance, you know, heading to Hayes's right leg, or more specifically the outside of it, and taking that angle. You know, I thought maybe we'd see maybe a little more southpaw stances from DJ, but by the way, if you hear that scratching, that's Benjamin. Poor allergy season has him just scratching like a crazy man. But yeah, so if you hear dog scratching, that's what it is. It's not me, I promise. But yeah, DJ was able to find those weak angles and stand like he does everything. The guy's just so, that's why he's my favorite commentator right now. Because he's just so accurate at how he was talking about DJ taking that weak angle, and how the little details of like putting his left hand on Wilson's, you know, right tricep and using that to kind of maintain his angle and load his right hands. And that was, you know, really impressive. So, you know, really impressive stuff, really impressive transitions inside the pocket, and just his awareness there. You know, you throw him up a weight class to the TJ Dillashaws and Cody Garbrands, of course he's going to have a risk of being hit and being liable. And you know, some of those matches, more so Garbrandt, I don't think would be that great for DJ on paper. So I'm not saying the guy's invincible, but man, people trying to poke holes the day after, it's really hard to. It's really hard to. And as far as the pound-for-pound argument, again, this is not a thing I usually kind of jump in to take, you know, it's because it's so subjective, and I just see people pull their hair out. But I will say that DJ is number one for me, and not just after tonight. It was something that I've said before, and I'm sure I've been on record saying it before. And it's not taking anything away from John Jones. You know, I pontificate on how great John Jones is, but it's perspective. And all the arguments you can say, first of all, the main argument, which I don't think is a great argument as far as resume goes, because that's perspective, first of all. It's hard for DJ, you know, to say, you know, oh, DJ hasn't faced the same former champions John Jones has, because one, you could make an argument that those former champions were on their way out and already in the advanced stages of their career. Secondly, who's the former champions of flyweight? Oh, wait, there's only been one champion, and it's been Demetrius Johnson. And, you know, it's hard to say, you know, I get it, you know, they're not as big names, but just because they're not as big names at flyweight doesn't mean they're not as good fighters. I mean, Horiguchi was pushed way too early. Horiguchi, his fight before his title shot, in the post-fight presser, he said, "I'm not ready for a title shot yet. I'd like more time to grow." And then they throw him in the title shot. Cejudo, you know, they throw him against him too early. And he's an Olympian who is still showing, you know, despite his, you know, his age and getting into the game late, he's showing fight-to-fight improvement, some of his biggest yet of most recently, even though, you know, he lost that controversial split decision to Benavidez. And Joseph Benavidez, you're going to tell me that he is not a great fighter? I mean, he could have been a former champion himself too, but, you know, his only losses are to Dominic Cruz and Demetrius Johnson. I mean, again, you don't have to agree or disagree, but you can't tell me that there is a hard line truth to that, because it's a perspective argument. Just like the pound for pound argument is a perspective argument. But what I will say about pound for pound is what annoys me is the thing that I hear less. I'm not saying that you specifically, person listening to this, does not bring this point up. But it's definitely not brought up as much as it should be, because if we're doing a pie graph, it's got a smaller piece of the pie. And that's what, in my opinion, pound for pound is all about, how well your skills translate. Or even, you know, when we were talking about DC, or when guys like BJ Penn in his prime were in the argument, which BJ Penn, I think, is the prototypical pound for pound fighter. That's the guy who really brought that to MMA, because he was the guy that opened up the lighter divisions and has the widest array of weight classes of competing against biggest names and big names at the time. I mean, even the small names on BJ Penn's list. Who's Joey Gilbert, or who are these guys? And you don't realize the connections to Matt Serra's gym, or like where these guys were rankings wise at the time. People don't look at those things, and it drives me crazy. And when you don't have, you know, it's going to be more rare, or maybe not, depending on with this whole money weight bullshit. But it seems to be more rare where you have the jumping of weight classes. Although I guess that's probably not true, because now we're seeing guys jump weight classes because of the new weigh-in limits, right? So, okay, maybe a bad example there. Point is, we don't see that many multi-divisional champions. That list has, you know, only, you know, McGregor, Randy Couture, and BJ Penn for a reason. It's a hard thing to do, no matter what era you were competing in. But if you don't have that sample size to pull from, we have to look at, okay, well, how does their skills match up pound for pound? And again, the most technical fighter, the guy everywhere, the guy that's good everywhere, you know, he can submit guys off his back. You know, I love Cormier, and I make the argument that Cormier is also above Jones, despite losing a head-to-head fight with him, which is a whole other argument that I'm not interested in getting into on this podcast, especially with myself. It's not really much of an argument when you're arguing with yourself, but Dan, you talk to yourself all the time. Shh. But at the end of the day, I essentially have Muddy Mouse at the top of my pound-for-pound argument for that reason. I mean, again, I love Daniel Cormier, but Daniel Cormier is not going to pull an armbar off of his back. And as great as John Jones is, and, you know, we'll see him pull guard all the time at the end of rounds, which is really weird. And I think it's more just to show off how good he is. He can say, hey, I'll make myself vulnerable, and I'm still going to win. Because he's just that good, and I'm not denying that. Believe me, I'm not trying to take away from anything from Jones or DC. But, yeah. That's my argument on why Johnson's the man. So if you want to participate in those pound-for-pound arguments, feel free. Feel free to take who you want to take. I'm just saying, I think y'all, as in not you specifically, the general y'all, should give more respect to the, you know, again, pound-for-pound comes from the motor vehicle. You know, if we're going to make a car, we want that torque of the V8, but we want some pickup off of the line. We want great handling. You know, we want some durability, but we don't want to be too heavy, because it's going to affect our mobility and nimbleness of the car. So this is where the pound-for-pound term comes from, and if we're going to translate that to fighters, well then, yeah, I'm going to be siding with the more technical guy every time, and that's often going to be found in the lighter weight divisions. So, yeah, give the guy some love. It's just it's not like it's going to increase his paycheck being the pound-for-pound fighter. So, yeah, anyways. Next one I really want to talk about, Souza versus Whitaker. Just so y'all know, if you were listening to the past episode, I thought it was going to be a pretty heated one in the downtown household. I've been high on Whitaker. I've honestly taken him in every fight since he's moved to middleweight. I first came across him in his loss, actually, to Wonderboy Thompson. And kind of followed him from there. And, but yeah, my girlfriend, her favorite fighter is Jacare Souza. So I was like, ooh, like I think I was able to avoid until the weigh-in day of, you know, telling her what my pick was. By then, my content was published so she could see it. And it was funny. So we were definitely both on opposite sides. But thankfully, we're both sensible fans of the sport. And we're able to, you know, still enjoy the fight. And it's a lot easier to swallow the pill when your guy loses when you got a guy like Whitaker who's just so classy. I mean, that was so awesome in this post-fight where he's like, as a fan, I was gutted to have to fight, you know, Jacare and giving him the proper respect and bowing to him. Like, how can you, you know, not hate on that guy? And if you're Australian, man, how are you not waving the flag? This is your guy. I mean, I know my friends, shout out to Submission Radio, one of the best podcasts out there. Great dudes as well, Dennis and Gasper. I know they're real high on their boy Whitaker, and we're really stoked to see him do well. But yeah, if you're Australian, yeah. You know, how are you not behind this guy? And even if you're not Australian, how are you not behind this guy? Bobby Knuckles, which there's a heated argument because I guess Whitaker said he didn't like that nickname. But I like Bobby Knuckles, and I don't think we really need to poll that. I think everybody likes, excuse me, Bobby Knuckles. I'm guessing Reaper. I think Reaper was a cool name, and that kind of actually what attracted me. I'm like, ooh, Reaper Whitaker. I'm like, that sounds like a fucking like gamer tag. Sure enough, Robert Whitaker is a video gamer. I don't know if that's his gamer tag, but Reaper sounds like, I bet you he was attached to that because, you know, that was like probably like his gamer tags in seventh grade. And he's on, you know, and it's a pretty badass nickname. Like you're probably like icing dudes in Counter-Strike with a name like Reaper. You know, you've probably got like a 31-2 kill to loss record, you know, with 70% headshots with a name like Reaper. But yeah, Bobby Knuckles, man, because you're not supposed to choose your nickname. And I'm not saying he did choose it. I'm just guessing it was his gamer tag. But yeah, more technics. Okay. This is a theme that we're going to touch on later in the card, but is a theme that was prevalent, which was body shots and wrist control. Body shots, by the way, DJ was putting in work to the body toward the end of rounds, and we were seeing fighters do that, including Whitaker towards Souza at the end of round one. And I like that. I'm not saying it's done on purpose, but this is sometimes a crafty kickboxing or boxing trick, depending the school of thought you're from, where you're kind of load up on body work. I mean, body work is more of something you're kind of building interest toward, to pay dividends later in the fight, whether it's taking stamina and or chopping down the tree, kind of like what leg kicks do. You're dropping their guard, you're dropping their sense of awareness to come high. The same thing, you know, we all hear people harp on it with kicks, but the same thing can be said for body work, except we just don't normally see body work in MMA until more recent years. We've finally been seeing strikers embrace it as the striking levels have raised in MMA. And one of the other kind of benefits of body shots is when you're kind of working for the bigger long-term objective, even within rounds, there's kind of a micro level of success you can achieve where you'll see guys go to the body toward the end of rounds because we're also, you know, the general we're also dependent on that 45 second of recovery time. I mean, you see corners, no matter how competent or incompetent you think they are, there's always, I think everybody is pretty well aware of the importance of breathing before they just drown their fighter with instructions. And you'll even see different breathing techniques. But the point is, whether you agree with them or not, there's an emphasis on breathing there. So what a lot of guys will do if they're smart and they have body work in their repertoire and they're finding success in it, especially like, you know, Whitaker was to Souza, because again, not just, you know, everybody, you know, was calling for the left hook. No surprise there, Dan. But yes, I was calling for the left hook because of a reliance on head movement. But the thing is, when you're relying on that head movement, a lot of times your trunk is still in place and still in play, which means your body's going to be there. So while it was still early, while Jacare still had his best reaction times on paper, we saw Whitaker work the body. And when you work the body, sorry for the long-winded explanation, toward the end of the round, when a guy is dependent on that 45 seconds to recover, you're kind of taking that away from him. You're kind of, you know, if it's a video game bar, you're kind of putting him behind the eight ball, kind of like Hicks and Gracie did to a more advanced stage with yoga and breathing, where he would purposely use yoga and his breathing techniques to get his heart rate at a lower level, but would fight and pressure his opponents, whether he was successful or not, to a point where their heartbeat would elevate. So whether he was finding success in, you know, getting guys into the clinch and working his game from there, Hickson was already able to hedge his bets and put raw numbers in his side as far as heartbeat, science, and the respiratory system, right? Because even though leg kicks pay certain dividends in setting up a high kick, leg kick is more of a physical trauma. And physical trauma is great, right? Whether you're talking about joints, muscle, or pain. And yes, body shots provide that same physical pain. But what you're attacking when you're attacking the body is it's more of a respiratory and central functioning system. So it's gonna make everything look worse. That's why Wilson Hayes came out looking progressively worse from the rounds. Like Brian Stan said, that and Fleury, Wilson Hayes blocked most of it, but he came out looking worse. And Souza the same way. Now, the intangible at play here is, yes, Souza's contract. I don't know if a lot of people are talking about that, But this was something that I mentioned when you know, the day of the weigh-ins, after Sue's already rehydrated and there's that video going around of him dancing. That's an adrenaline dump right there. When I saw that, I'm like, that's an adrenaline dump. That's bad. I mean, because there are two adrenaline dumps, basically, you have to save your energy for. There are two fights. You ask any fighter. That's the weight cut and, of course, the fight itself. And DJ brought up a good point in his post-fight speech saying that when everybody was celebrating, oh, I had the weight cut, what was I doing? Tyron Woodley witnessed what I was doing. I was running through what was going to go down in the fight and getting back on tune, back on target, and taking those beats to get ahead of everybody else. And we saw it because, yes, I mean, yeah, DJ's DJ, but not just him being DJ, not just him winning, not just him winning in spectacular fashion. He did it in the exact way that was practiced and rehearsed to do so. And so, again, DJ was taking advantage of that adrenaline dump. So not only was Jacare facing the same adrenaline dump that, yes, Whitaker and everybody else had to face, you know, in their own ways, for better or worse, once you make weight, but Souza had a second adrenaline dump that day. You have to imagine the narrative of his contract wasn't just obviously strong with this being his last fight, but if you're a hardcore fan following Souza, you know that the narrative of his contract and a title shot and his standing in the organization has been something at play. It's been, you know, bothering him to whatever levels. I'm sure he's a pro and, you know, mitigated it the best he could, but that does play a factor at some level or another. And it's boiling over in this pot that he's been keeping over on the side because he has to focus and keep his kitchen instruments sharp. But meanwhile, he has this pot over there that's gaining heat and it's raising, it's simmering, it's about to boil over, and boom, he gets an early relief. I mean, I'm sure he's coming in prepared to this fight. I'm sure he's prepared to win. Of course, he's Jacare fucking Souza. But boom, before, you know, after one momentum takeaway from the weigh-ins and before he's storing up to regain, you know, all that energy he needs for the other, he has that drain. He has that, you know, that drain I just spoke of. And you see him dancing, signing the contract. And sure, that's a relief. And in hindsight, this was good because if he did lose, now at least he's been taken care of. So this was a good thing business-wise. But I'm talking about the intangibles of performance. Jacare didn't look the same out there. Now, yes, he's getting older. I've been the one touting that. That's part of the reason why I picked against Jacare, is because his reaction times aren't looking the same, and that's why that reliance on head movement was going to cost him. But he looked extra drained, guys. He looked extra not poppy. And as soon as the body shot and then the right hand, yes, it was a right hand, not the left hook, that dropped him, that was the first level drop down. And then we saw Souza even at a lower level when he came back to that next round. And in the first round, though, there was a point where Jacare gets the back, but before that, he gets a takedown, and you see Whitaker do a roll through. And Jacare has a great outside angle where, again, it's not even prime Jacare. He doesn't take people down with his reactionary shots. He uses the reactionary shots to press guys against the cage and then works his chain off, sucks hips out, or even chains off to a far kind of outside single, you know, utilizing the outside reap with his leg. And that's what he did to Robert Whitaker, except Robert Whitaker did it something that I love. Again, is wrist control. Wrist control in all its many forms, whether it's two-on-one grips, which are huge. And my other favorite one is a cross wrist position. And you kind of hear people refer to cross grips or cross rips in different ways. Sometimes it can be used whether, you know, you're on bottom in side control or in half guard, as we'll get to later, but how Anthony Smith used it, where you're reaching across, you know, you're using your left hand to grab the inside wrist of your opponent's left hand who's on top of you. Or there's cross wrist, you'll hear it referenced when one guy is on the back and the guy on the back will be reaching, you know, under the armpit of the fighter he's taken the back of, and he's grabbing their wrists, the inside of their wrists. And that's an important control position we see all the time. You'll see guys turtled, and guys will kind of, you know, go from a side ride where a guy will be turtled and they'll be kind of hugging their hips on top of him with one arm off to the side and punching him with the other. And you'll see guys, you know, wrestlers will kind of reach in deep with the hip, but you'll see other guys, more jiu-jitsu guys, kind of reach in and grab the inside of the arm. Well, that's what Whitaker did when Souza got in on his hips and went to the outside reap and got off to an angle. You see Whitaker reach over the back of Souza and grab that inside forearm / wrist. And that was really important, because when Souza took him down, Whitaker was able to, yes, use the momentum to roll through, but Souza would have still rolled through with him as he did and took top position if not for this wrist. What that wrist does, if you, I know this is video, so it's very tough. I apologize. Again, we're going to work on some YouTube stuff in the works, but if you go back and look at it, you're going to see that cross wrist, that cross wrist grip that I'm talking about. Whitaker has it from with his left hand reaching over the shoulder and back of Souza and grabbing the inside of Souza's left forearm and wrist, and that grip gives him just enough friction to pull Souza's grip away from the leg. Which again, if you only have one arm, not only can you, is it very difficult? You can choke someone with one arm, depending there. Circumstances, but not only is it difficult to choke someone or submit someone with one arm, but you can't pass or hold position as well either. That's why wrist controls is the unsung hero. You grab a wrist and pin a wrist, you just take away so much they can do. So that wrist control not only takes Souza's hand just enough from him being able to secure the position he likes, but it also allows Whitaker the leverage to kick out his hips, or I should say, kick out his left leg, which in turn kicks out his hip position and allows that hip position to get back reset and away, you know, to nullify that outside reap and to nullify the takedown. He's able to get back up. Now, in getting back up, he does a slight turtle, which is how Souza was able to take his back. But Whitaker was aware of it the whole time, and he went to the fence smartly to pin his back. You know, you hear it in commentary a lot. He's pinning his back to the, you know, to the cage so the guy can't take his back, and that's important. That's something I look for. But even though Whitaker smartly looked for that, that's not why Souza's back take failed, okay? Because if you look at it, Souza has his right hook in, which is from the far side of the cage, and Souza sees that Whitaker is looking to put his back to the cage to cut off his secure route. So Souza actually beats him to the chase. And you'll see Souza put his left hook in, sliding his left leg just between the cage and Robert Whitaker before, you know, beating Robert Whitaker before he can cut Souza off. And Souza actually gets his hook in. But at the same time, you'll see Souza lose his right hook. And now in replaying it, the reason why Souza loses that hook is because Whitaker is doing something that I do a lot. As a guy who plays from turtle, I have to do this a lot. And I don't see guys do this a lot. And I don't see it spotted by commentators. Although Stan, as great of a commentator as he is, he did spot this principle that I'm about to elaborate on a separate fight, and that is talking about elbows to block hooks out. And now Stan was talking about it, as I just referenced, from a turtle, where there was a fighter earlier in the card who was turtled, and they were smartly, and that actually might have been Anthony Smith, and they were smartly, you know, using the elbows to protect hooks. Now, a lot of guys are so worried about protecting their neck as they should be, because a lot of times you get your back taken and rear naked choked when you're turtled. But if you're smart and you know where the choke's at, or you're good with that position, you'll see guys that are good at, you know, good at the turtle, they'll kind of tuck their head in, and they'll maybe only have a hand up, like kind of like a shelling defense to block a potential, you know, arm weaving in. And what they'll do is they'll, if they're smart, they delegate double duty to that hand and elbow. So again, for a visual, if a guy is using a shell defense standing to block strikes where, you know, you're putting your hand on your kind of ear and your temple and your elbow is kind of pointing out to your opponent. Well, the same thing is if you're turtled, you're on your knees, your forehead is to the mat, your hands are kind of near your chin, cheek, temple area, and your elbows are kind of pointed into your hips. And the double duty there is the hands kind of block punches from the side ride. It blocks the arm weaving through for the rear naked choke. And if you keep your hand kind of pasted to your head as a pivot point and you use that to work your elbow has a little bit of room there to move and defend hooks. So what you see is when Jacare gets his left hook and beats him in between the cage, at the same time he's doing that, Robert Whitaker protecting his neck the whole time, keeping, if you look at his right hand plastered to the side of his face, his elbow, it's very subtle, it's called elbow block. His elbow subtly pivots and scoops. He uses that point of his elbow like an ice cream scoop, like a spoon, and he scoops and pops the leg out of the hip. And when not only did he do that, he did it at the right time when Jacare was emphasizing on getting his other side in. So the momentum of Jacare focusing on his left hook and Whitaker disentangling his right hook spun Jacare off in front of him down, and there we saw Jacare's best chance to slip away as it was downhill from there. Robert Whitaker does the classic it was kind of sloppy. You know, I believe Stan refers to it as wild in the commentary, but it was the same thing he hit Tavares with. You know, I'm a huge fan of Brad Tavares, you know, Hawaiian Extreme Couture guys. Hate to bring that up, but it was a beautiful finish, though, by Whitaker, where he throws the front kick and uses that leverage. A lot of time, the natural leverage is almost for a check hook to come back, but he comes forward with his hooks off of his front kicks, you know, because he's got that explosive pop and it's the way he holds his stance. And that's a lot of that's coming from the Hapkido background. Even though I did not do Hapkido, I see the similarities of that with the Taekwondo as far as Korean style goes, being light on the feet and the benefits to kind of being up high in that bounce. And then, of course, yes, I'm also would also see the Kenpo Karate influence there as that is the lineage that I do share with Whitaker. So just kind of seeing how he's able to apply these to the MMA and boxing realms just continues to blow my mind. It really does. And then, of course, what he finished was the right high kick. And that is actually a strong weapon of his. But I didn't touch on that in the breakdown is because he usually only goes to it with southpaws. And so I didn't think we would see it that much. But if you look, every time he throws and lands it, it's when Souza steps back defensively into a southpaw stance. And he throws it like muscle memory, which is beautiful. He hurts him with the left. Souza steps back into a southpaw stance, and just like muscle memory, just like he did with Derek Brunson, he throws the 1-2, gets you to slip outside of the 2, and head kick, which we're going to see in the next fight, which was Rose versus Watterson. By the way, you know, shout out to anybody who was on that Whitaker train. He definitely saved my butt. The dude was an underdog, I believe, in like 5 out of his last 6 fights. So by the numbers, I believe Will Martin, shout out to @WillMartinMMA, posted the numbers if you want to go find his Twitter handle as to why Whitaker was on at Best Fight Picks. Shout out to Daniel Levy's top 5 underdogs and why he's been the most profitable underdog and is on my list of that as well. So shout out to y'all. Next is Rose versus Watterson. This was on my Fights to Avoid because I thought it was going to be the closest fight, at least on paper. And it wasn't. And though I was, you know, right in my pick and, you know, for whatever that's worth, which is not much, believe me, I don't get too high on that, especially for fights like these that I avoided like hot fire. Rose gets it done and gets it done inside the distance and makes it, just fights the perfect fight. Now, Watterson looked great shape, so you know you can kind of check that intangible in her favor. And one of the things, and this isn't the reason why, maybe it kind of is because it was so close, and it probably did come down to inches, but I did state in the breakdown, in other words, that the intangible that wasn't going to be in Watterson's favor was the media hype. She never had this before, and we saw it to Rose, and we saw Rose falter from it. We saw it to Paige, and we saw Rose capitalize on Paige from it. And now Rose has capitalized on another fighter. And now the reason why Rose is so hard to pick, and I heard a lot of people out there, including myself, I admittedly said it too, and I still stand by it. The reason why Rose is so hard to pick, and a lot of these fighters, when I look at fighters that I have a hard time picking, like Cerrone, it's because of mental intangibles. It's because they're so damn talented, they can beat anybody in the division, but it's so cliche, but so true that they are their biggest, worst enemies. So when you have people that they feel that way, you know, they control their destiny so strongly, it can almost be a detriment, especially as a, you know, if you're looking at it from a gambling aspect to where you put your money on, you know, because MMA is crazy enough and fighting high level fighters is hard enough, you know? So when you include that intangible, it gets really tricky in picking. But that being said, with Rose being through the experience, being burned, showing that she could come back from it, having a winning record, only losing a close split decision. And I know, yes, I picked Tisha Torres, and you can make the argument that Tisha Torres won that close split decision, but still it was a close fight. And her only loss was a close loss to Karolina Kowalkiewicz, who only continues to impress and almost dethroned the champion in one of the rounds in their last fight. So when you look at it on numbers, not only she come back on and won and answered physically, but even psychologically, she just ousted the two girls with the hype machine and all that behind them, and she's experienced that before. So on paper, she is more psychologically equipped than anybody, minus obviously Joanna Jędrzejczyk, who just is a mental giant. But yeah, outside of the champ JJ, you can now make the argument on paper that Rose has one of the strongest mental intangibles. Crazy. Big fan of Rose, though. Big fan of Watterson. Again, I'm glad UFC is pushing a fighter of media wise that's of Asian descent. We don't have that much representation, and you know, double marks because it's a female. great story behind Michelle Waterson. Again, there's so many reasons why I dig her, and you know, y'all should dig her too. So I hope she bounces back from this, and I hope, you know, I don't think there's going to be excuses from her or anything. So whatever it was, we probably won't know. But whatever it is, I hope, you know, she bounces back, and you know, it just could have been a stylistic matchup. And again, Waterson also came out at Southpaw. She mainly comes out Orthodox. Now, Southpaw is more kind of her home base when you look back at earlier footage. And, you know, coming from the karate style, it produces a lot of Southpaws. So that's not as worrisome. But this game plan smacked, and they referenced it a bit in the show, but it smacked a lot of Mike Winklejohn, which believe me, I'm going to be the last to criticize a guy like that. Okay, dude probably forgot more about fighting than I know, so. But at the same time, you know, the one criticism you can say is you can really tell the fighters that embrace his game plan coming from that Jackson Wink camp, because they're you know, I equate it to like, you know, torpedo bomb planes. You know, they're running those same circling in the same patterns and this and that. You know, now it was reminiscent to Holly in that regard, but she wasn't exiting to weak sides. And that's the one thing about Holly. She's much more predictable, but she's predictable in a conservative way, where at least Holly's going to be exiting to the you know, weaker sides to increase her percentages of safety when she exits her exchanges. Now, Waterson was doing more of the Stephen Thompson approach, where she was doing the southpaw versus orthodox fighter, but exiting to the power side and using that heavy slip to the outside. Now, her initial, she did this a bunch in the beginning, so Rose smartly picked up on it, or maybe her corner did. I have to go back and listen to corner audio, but initially, Michelle wasn't doing it for too long, and when she was slipping, she was something I remember Pat Miletich teaching us in a practice, and it all stuck with me. One of the few times I had the pleasure of working with that guy, he said, when you're going to slip far to the outside, that's fine, but you need to be breaking. Imagine there's a wall on both sides of you whenever you slip, and you can't break that wall with your head. You only can break that wall with your forearm and elbow. So if you keep that rule of thumb when you slip, as far as keeping that shield there, you know, you can still obviously, you know, go into a head kick and it still crush through and knock you out. But as far as upping your percentages, or if you're going to emphasize head movement, you have to have that hand attached. And that always stuck into me when Pat said that. And Michelle had it initially, but she didn't in the second round. And again, she looked very compromised. I don't know if maybe she put on too much muscle, because we saw her steadily put on more and more muscle since she's moved up, and considerably more this time around. But she that explosiveness a lot of people associate Waterson with was really gone after those armbar attempts. And I said, you know, she's got slick armbar attempts, but not only is Rose the better on paper grappler, but she capitalizes well on those. And even though Michelle didn't use her arm bars that she normally does to roll through and create scrambles and give her back to Rose, Rose was still able to defend and punish her with ground and pound that changed the momentum and still took her back anyways. And again, my stat was that Rose Namajunas, even including Carla Esparza, has scored takedowns on all of her UFC opponents. And in every fight where she was able to establish a back mount, she has won. And that's outside of the UFC too. And that trend continues. She took the back, and I tweeted that. And before the fight was over, and not saying she was going to win, but it was like, that hedges it strongly in her favor though. And sure enough, she was able to capitalize after the after that head kick landed, because again, Waterson did that far outside slip. And yeah, props to Rose's gauging and off that jab. It's not just, you know, using the jab, it's fighting long and fighting in the spirit that the jab is meant to facilitate, a range game, right? So that's what she did. She used the range to find her opening. The opening was there, read it like a robot, and yeah, I think we're going to be seeing some girls be dressing up as Rose or the girl from Stranger Things, or both. It's going to be a popular costume this year for Halloween. All right, next one on the main card. This is going longer than I thought. I was going to try to run through with no break, but we'll do a break after this this next one here. Stevens versus Moicano. This was probably, we went 9-4 of the losses. This one probably hurt the most. I just felt like it was... It's not that I'm, you know, confident on Stevens normally, or, you know, even this matchup with the way it laid out. But the reason why I was so confident in this matchup is because it was one of those ones where I would have lined it much higher. And I just really felt like a too much too soon scenario for Moicano. Stevens has actually improved his game. You know, you can make arguments that he's improved his game as opposed to faded as most guys would at this advanced age, this many fights in the UFC, his type of style, you'd expect to see it. And maybe this fight was that, but it just seemed off. I didn't realize he wasn't working with Eric Del Fiero. I did realize he was training more around town, but these were good looks. I mean, this was over at the Roofka Gym I think Daryl Yeesh. I can't pronounce that guy's, but the wrestling and grappling coach a lot of those San Diego and Southern California people use. So, I mean, even Miles Jury, say what you will against Miles Jury, but he fit the frame and maybe not necessarily stylings, although, yeah, actually, when you look at the way Mike Connell fought this fight as opposed to his others, which I'll get to in a second, yeah, I mean, he had good training partners, so I definitely don't want to make excuses by any means for Stevens there because all those pluses he had on his side going into it, but yeah, seeing Del Fiero there, I'd be lying if that was not very troublesome. And then sure enough, as the fight progressed, we saw those traditional tropes of Steven coming through. And props, by the way, to people who are on Moicano. I didn't see a lot of people. I know my man Daniel Levy, again, shout out to Best Fight Picks there. I know he was big on to him. And you know, I didn't get the – you know, I disagreed with the read, but – he was right in the sense of volume was going to do it. Now, the reason why I didn't think so is because even though Moicano threw with volume, it was still kind of a sloppy volume. He still left his head there to be hit. And again, although I was higher on, you know, to Hugoff than the guy who he previously faced than most others, it's still a skewed sample size because we only saw two fights in 2 years from, you know, Moicano, and that's troubling no matter who you like. And even though his lanky frame doesn't look like he has power, and I was one of the few people saying, like, this kid's got real pop on his kicks, and you could hear it. Stevens is a tough SOB, but if you can read Stevens' body language, you could see that he was even respecting those kicks to a certain extent. At least it was, you know, so hard that he was having trouble countering after because the pop of Moicano's kicks was so heavy. But it's just Moicano lacked movement. He was too plotty, and just his overall flow didn't look like, you know, it wasn't something that, you know, spoke to me. And I wouldn't go so far to say it was non-athletic, but it definitely wasn't, you know, special if you were to ask me. But not that he looked special this time out, but I will defend, you know, him against, you know, people criticizing Moicano online or the crowd booing him. Man, the kid showed major improvements. He wasn't plotty at all. You could say he was running, but again, this is Jeremy Stevens. You know, Moicano landed really good shots throughout the first two rounds to know, like, okay, I'm not going to put this guy away. Even though he had a check hook that I thought could be worth to watch for, he didn't stick around, you know, to land it like Eve Edwards was able to do against Jeremy Stevens. But so yeah, I don't criticize it at all. In fact, when you look at Moicano's past, that was a big improvement. If I saw Moicano move like that, I may have still picked Stevens, to be honest, but I probably would have moved him off of my recommended pieces for your parlay. So lesson learned there. Props if you're on Moicano. And when we come back after this break, we're going to do and knock through the undercard of UFC Kansas City as we recap the technical action here on the Protect Your Neck podcast. Cucarachas enojadas. Right here on the Protect Your Neck podcast to break down the prelims for UFC Kansas City. And that's going to bring us in our theme, if we're going from top to bottom, to Roy Nelson versus Alexander Volkov. Now, I stated my bias here. This is the second time I scouted for Nelson. The first time was against Silva. And no, I didn't put Kick John McCarthy in the scouting report. But unfortunately, couldn't get the win for Big Roy this time. Again, I have no say, by the way, in game plan. When I work with him and through his team, this is early on in the camp. I just provide an opinion, a pretty in depth one. But where they go, that's where they take it. There are much more people, not just in that camp, but in any camps of fighters I do scout for. You know, you have to always imagine. I mean, obviously, but you always have to imagine that, you know, there's way more qualified people, and they know their fighters better, which is always going to make them more qualified than you. So that's not my job. It's just simply to provide some information out there. But with the information, the way I broke this one down, is what I'm trying to get to here, is I actually, you know, biased or not, I actually would have picked Roy. I felt that this was a very winnable fight for him. You know, not making excuses, because I don't know the behind the scenes, and I try to know as little as possible in certain things, but not that I would share them here. But, or at least something like this, but is the gas tank for Roy just really, you know, I mean, he's had performances, you know, he's had bad performances before for sure. I mean, you dating all the way back to when he was making his run, you know, the fight that kind of nilched that run, which was that Stipe fight, was the end of his contract, and came out and just looked tired. And unfortunately, you know, you flash forward through his ups and downs. We saw that again here, you know, I believe toward the end of his contract, or at least he was, according to the interviews and stuff, the way he was speaking about the UFC, sounds like it was toward the end of his contract. And yeah, he gets tired out. And not that the pressuring approach was bad. People were saying, oh, you got to, someone was having this argument, and like, you got to be able to work within range, you know, with a taller guy. You'll just get picked apart if you stay outside of range. And I get that in theory, but I guess kind of a peek behind the curtain of what I will say is, one of the things I was kind of suggesting for a guy like Roy was maybe more along the lines of a Tyron Woodley approach. And again, that sounds questionable in theory. I too was one who was like questioning a guy like Tyron Woodley, you know, and active. But what Tyron Woodley shows that, you know, you question his activity, which you all you want. If you really look at what he's doing and how he's setting himself up to win, he's really maximizing his chances for his wrestling and that weapon of the right hand. And when looking at Volkov, most of the time where he was hittable was when he was coming forward. Volkov comes from a karate base traditionally, and he's, you know, rounded his game much more kickboxing centric and Thai boxing centric game as he's been in MMA. But especially when you look at his early footage, Volkov was more of that pull and return kind of karate swag, right? And he would really want to use the pressure to kind of force those counters. But when he's adopted more of the kickboxing and kind of the more come forward combinations, that's where he's been traditionally getting tagged more. Maybe because, you know, that was the newer part of his game, and obviously he's only improved that, and those opportunities were much less this time around. That was kind of the thought there, you know. And also, you know, when you look at, you know, for whatever reason, Roy's gas tank, what it was, maybe that Woodley approach would have, you know, served him well as far as conserving the gas tank as well. You know, and again, even if you miss on your collisions, you know, there's colliding when you strike with somebody, and Roy's really good at that. I felt that letting Volkov initiate and colliding when he initiated was going to pay big dividends for Roy. And if not, he'd be able to parlay those missed right hands into body lock clinches where he thrives. And if he was already, you know, waiting outside by the cage, he wouldn't have far to turn Volkov around and work his game against there, because Roy has a harder time taking guys down in the open because of his frame, and Volkov is easier defending takedowns in the open as well. So, yeah. So, I mean, but again, you know, this is all armchair quarterback bullshit that I'm saying, you know. But yeah, no, you know, and I'm not making excuses, so I hope it doesn't come off in that spirit, because Volkov looked good. You know, people, you know, criticize him running, you know, what are you going to do? You're going to stand there and crack with Roy Nelson? And, you know, I don't know if he's going to be able to buck for main card slot or money fights or big fights, I should say, with a performance like that. That criticism is valid for Volkov. But, you know, as far as the judges getting it wrong or right, I felt the judges got it right. And, you know, no controversy there. Just really interested to see where Roy's going, and really wish the best for him. All right, next fight is Dukinwa versus Williams. Wow, okay, so this was cool. I like it. I like that Patrick Williams. I was kind of hoping that we would see some adversity for Dukinwa. I mean, we saw some early adversity through little windows and positions of his earlier fights in Bama. And, you know, of course, of his loss to Makwan Amerikani up a division. But I'm glad that he got tagged here. Because he recovered well. Like, I like looking at a guy's eyes, you know, not just to see how well they recover, but what's the psychological intent? Because we can't control how well we recover in this game of inches, but what you can see is someone's psychological intent. And I liked what I saw from Dukinwa as he got back on the horse and recovered. And he was just, well, it was just amazing that he was just, I mean, he knew what was coming. Obviously, you know, a wrestler, a power guy, a come-forward guy, you're going to want to set traps as far as counters go in general, but especially setting traps around the takedown. And just the way you would see him kind of step to the outside angle, feint an uppercut, throw a front kick at a certain tempo, just kind of baiting these certain tempos and giving looks, is he wanted to give a look to dissuade, but also wanted to give a false tempo to invite. And that is signs of a really good trap setter. So forget whatever the word hype and Duquesnoy, as they've been synonymous with one another this whole weekend. Look at those specifics. There is a lot to like there. And the numbers back it up, because he landed with 74% as far as his total strikes. I mean, Duquesnoy was 36 for 49, 74% in his debut against a guy who came out under fire and found success. Granted, that back half, we saw a clear fade in Williams, as he kind of tends to do in his fights, and as you'd only expect from a guy with, you know, only, I believe, what was it, 2 fights in 2 years. He's an older gentleman with athletic miles from wrestling who is cutting down to compete at the lighter weight. Those guys' life expectancies don't do as well when you start dealing with those age intangibles and lower weight. So there's a lot to like from Duquesnoy. I don't want to get too crazy more, because I know the odds makers are already going to be getting crazy with his next line. I was even playing hard inside the distance at minus 245, and this was this guy's first fight. So if you played that, congratulations. It was a crucial parlay piece that paid off big. As yes, Tom Duquesnoy was a recommended parlay piece that scored big for us. Enjoy it while it lasts, because we're going to see inflated lines until he loses again. Because as great as he is, and I don't want to think about him losing, this is MMA, folks. They don't care about hype narrative. None of the above. Next fight, Smoker versus Elliott. This was not on the stay away, but pretty much a stay away, because I stayed the F away. Smoker by sub looked tempting at plus 1,000, but it's so tough because, again, I'm a big Smoker fan. You know, I was a 5'9 Hawaiian. God, I don't know how he makes that weight, by the way. I wouldn't mind seeing him at 135. I don't think his problems are gonna really rely on what weight class he's in as far as flyweight to bantamweight. I think his problems, again, more the psychological, you know. You heard how tough he took the first hiccup to Brandon Moreno, who proved to be a sleeper to us all. You know, don't feel bad, Smoker. I mean, that dude was a sleeper on many of us, and has only looked good since, and excited about that kid. But yeah, and then he has lost to Borg, who, you know, I thought, you know, it was going to be a close fight, because I was high on Borg like everybody was on the beginning, but from the missing weight to the intangibles of a plateau of his career, I got off that train. But then when you start to hear that, you know, the lawsuit and the issues that were happening with the Fit NHB and Tom Vaughn, you know, you start to wonder how much of it was due to that. Now he's working with Brandon Gibson, who I'm real high on, and you see the striking improvements. So yeah, I mean, there's a lot to like there. You know, as far as, you know, I mean, there's a lot to, you know, excuse there. Sorry, I'm getting this phone call.
Hello, Neo. Do you know who this is?
All right, I'm back. Sorry about that. I had to take that call. I've been getting lit up on the phone. Of course, despite it being a Sunday and me being a person who, being swamped with work, constantly just tries to insulate myself in a cave and just get to that work and not be distracted, the phone calls do come in always at the inappropriate times, because that's what you get for recording a podcast during the day and not doing it at night. But it's okay. I'm actually happy. Like, I kind of like doing it this way too, because I actually, you know, aside from not being so alcohol induced, which apologies for a good handful of these, it's kind of a thing on the Protect Your Neck podcast. If it was a loaded revolver about, you know, Russian roulette, it's about 3 chambers loaded with drunk casts there. But no, I really like, you know, just getting a nice a sober technical take, you know. And I say that soberly. I mean, because even, you know, you're not drinking or this or that, we all make hot takes, right? After an event, we have to go back and we have to look and go, okay, well, you know what? Maybe I scored it differently, and, you know, this and that. So I guess that's what I mean there. So hopefully you like this more in-depth one, but I'm going to speed this up a bit as we cut through the last of these prelims, because it is going a bit longer than I'd like. But yeah, Smoker, Elliott, Scramble Fest, stayed away. I dig that Elliott's working with Robert Follis. Shout out to Robert Follis. Great, great coach, obviously. A little biased. I work with him over at Extreme Couture, but real unsung hero, one of the old school guys at Team Quest, continues to evolve and teach the generations of upcoming fighters. Excited to see what he can do with Elliott on this run. And also, shout out to Zane Simon, who I saw a tweet he said earlier. Was like, can we see Borg versus Elliott now? Like, that fight, talk about, you know, that'll be Scramble Fest 2017 too. All right, next is Sterling versus Mendez. This was number 1 on the avoid list as well, or number 2, I should say. I did pick Sterling, although I just felt it was a lot closer on paper. I felt this line was way off. Now, that said, Sterling came out and had a great performance. He showed those improvements that he showed the Sun Sal fight, and he lost that fight, and it wasn't the most exciting fight, so it got overlooked, you know, it was on the prelims. But when you go back and watch, there was so much to like. If you're really watching Sterling's game, there's so much to like. Now, I was one who picked, who would criticize, you know, him at boxing range before, but he's worked so hard on that, and he showed the improvements in the Sun Sal fight, and he furthered those improvements and was sitting down with some pop on his punches here against Mendez, who was pop on his punches as well, was able to even kind of drop. I don't know how much of it might have been on the shoulder or an off-balance thing, but, you know, he tagged Sterling early in the first round, if memory serves. But Sterling just did a lot of the in and out on the feet and those little, the small grappling exchanges that I expect he would. And just did it at a much better rate, just did it much better technique. So I'm really excited to see stuff from Sterling there. Although, if you all on the fade Sterling train, it's going to take a certain matchup to do so. But there may be the value to do so because the line was stupid high on him for this fight, and the fact that he looks so good, expect inflated lines on Sterling coming forward. Next is Clark Collier. This was almost on an avoid list, but it just was kind of as is. I think everybody kind of was on the same opinion on this. You didn't need my warning. And the breakdown is kind of how it played out. You know, Clark's wrestling and top control was gonna ultimately be the factor against the guy coming up from 185. And Collier didn't look like he put on quality weight. So it didn't look like his weight was going to help him. And quality weight or not quality weight doesn't help you when you're on the bottom against a superior top player. I don't know if Clark did karate as a kid, but he was showing, you know, or maybe that, I think he's working with Jackson Wink now or this or that, so maybe he's getting a lot of those influences there from those alternate styles, but he almost had that karate swag as far as that pull and return in and out of range, and it can be dangerous where you have your hands when you move that way, because your hands obviously always naturally go low, but what it does signal is that despite getting stopped by Alex Nicholson, who, you know, is a guy who can stop people, we've learned, he doesn't seem dissuaded from striking. He seems comfortable. So whatever criticisms he can make, I'm sure he's going to improve. He's young. What weighs much more to me is the fact that he looks comfortable there. So expect bigger lines on Clark, too, because props to you if you were on him, because you're getting them between minus like 120 and minus 150 range all week long. So good price on Clark for a fight that played out how it should have on paper. Smith Sanchez is next. Man, this one was one that you know, I'm always a guy who kind of maybe will defend Anthony Smith more than others. That's why this was number one on the fights to avoid list. Even though I picked Sanchez, there were certain things from Smith to watch out for. You know, Sanchez kind of does that karate pull and return stuff too. But against a guy who's longer, commits to strikes, and is dangerous like Smith, who strikes out off the break, you know, not just in the clinch where I'm real high on Anthony Smith with his knees and elbows, but he'll parlay those elbows to hooks off the break. And then he turns his shoulders out and his cross and really follows you while you're just trying to get away from him. And he puts those punches together smoothly. It definitely paid off for him here. But before I get to that finish, I just want to say that risk control theme that I was touching on earlier, Anthony Smith shows it beautifully, because he does what I was talking about earlier in the podcast, is using a cross wrist where he was in half guard and he didn't even have that butterfly or the strong knee across the belly to have your normal leverage. And usually, you know, sit-up sweeps are underused from half guard. Most people know about the sit-up sweeps from full guard. I'm a big fan of using sit-up sweeps from half guard, but a lot of times you have to kind of get underneath a guy and toward his back and kind of almost like reaching behind him, you know, where your near side underhook would go. You'll use your far side hand and kind of dig and dive through and sit all the way up, bumping your hip to bump them over. Now, Anthony Smith did that, but instead of reaching all the way through with his right hand, he used his right hand and reached across to Sanchez's right hand for a cross grip. And not only that, he has a cross grip for a couple seconds but doesn't get the sweep. The reason why he gets the sweep is what makes the cross grip strong. I mean, that grip, you know, as I talked about, can stifle advancements, chokes, and everything etc. But if you go look at the replay, not only is he using that cross grip, but he's using that elbow as a fulcrum, as a for a leverage, and he digs into the inside of the same forearm that he's grasping, and that creates the space for him to set up and bump Andrew Sanchez over for that beautiful sweep. And Sanchez is a way better grappler than Smith on paper and within the MMA realm. You only got to look at a couple of their fights apiece to even start to see that and for that to be clear. So that was super impressive. And then it was followed by a shitty stand-up. I mean, I'm midway typing the tweet, and I kind of sent it out as was, where I was breaking down that whole transition. And then Yamasaki, I believe it was Yamasaki, stands him up. And it was just really unfortunate. Like, he earned that, you know? Like, forget the fact that it was a beautiful technique. Like, he did it against a guy who he's not supposed to do that to on paper. Like, you could not have earned that position more to work. And was a terrible stand-up. I know I was not alone, from the commentary to the tweets. And my last tweet, which I did, I will kind of, you know, I didn't play it. I wish I did. But I did tweet this out. I said, the reason why this is something I avoid is because Sanchez's most vulnerable round as well. Sanchez's most vulnerable round is the third round. And I said, let's see how this shakes out. And sure enough, Anthony Smith finds the finish in the third round. So I saw that was a big parlay buster for some people, so hopefully the rest of y'all took my advice on the avoid section. That is the one thing I will pat myself on the back. My avoid section is usually pretty damn accurate as far as just what intangibles are at play or if lines are off. And whether it shakes out that way or not, you know, but a lot of times it does, and this one did. So hopefully you avoided that. I did. The next one is Cummings and Coy. I should have put Cummings on here instead of Stevens, and I mean, that would have been super chalky, I know, because it would have been off minus three or four hundreds, but that's not how I do it, because, you know, it comes down to who's going to win and who's not. If you go by the numbers game, that's how you get into trouble. That's why that value word, guys like Joey Odessa could say, it could be very dangerous, because you can either win or not. You start chasing value, you start chasing bets that aren't there. But Cummins, I did feel strong about, so I did put him in some parlays personally, so he paid off there. I like his southpaw stylings, you know, his ability to counter and return have only gotten better. And his grappling, obviously, is really good, better than the black belt, and, you know, BJJ would suggest, is just a good no-gi grappler. And essentially, I tweeted this out, but if you look toward the end, Coy goes for kind of a takedown, gets close, and it's just, you really see Cummings' lever awareness as far as, you know, levers being your hands or legs. In this case, it was a leg, since the leg is what was posting on for the weight. You know, this was a standing attempt for Coy to try to take Cummings down. But Cummings' lever awareness was able to kick and pop his hip back, knowing that Coy needed that lever to secure the takedown and cut the angle to secure the takedown. And Cummings just did that small, there's a small little battle if you go back and watch there, where he just pops his hip out, and that was the key. That's what opened up then Coy to push forward, because there's now nothing there to finish. So he kind of goes forward out of balance, which in turn exposes his neck. Cummings grasps onto the neck and finishes it, and you have that ridiculously late stoppage. So that was horrible. But yeah, and great job, Brian Stan, of just having that awareness and not take away from Cummins' moment, but still berate the ref. I think Anik and Stan have been doing a better job at kind of combating the BS in an appropriate fashion. They can only do so much. They have to represent the company and not take away from the action, but kind of pointing out the confusionness of the fighters and to all watching for this joke that is right now regulation over our sport. And the last fight, Evan Smith versus Vieira. I picked Evan Smith, but this was an avoid one as well, because the sample sizes were really, really, really weird here. And you could see, like, Evan Smith tried to make, you know, like, improvements in her pulling and returning game, but this was the wrong fight to do so. Her normal pressure wrestling game and pressure striking would have been much, much better suited, because Vieira, not only, you know, was she playing into Vieira's strengths, but Vieira improved her strengths. I mean, I compared her to, she looked like a more active Hawkrin Diaz, and she was doing those, you know, those really subtle lead foot pivots to kind of not keep herself in balance, on range, and able to counter every time, because she wasn't overextending herself and playing into that pull and return game. She was, she was handling her kind of like a Aldo versus Edgar, and really relying on those rear foot pivots to keep him on balance and ready for whatever Edgar, or in this case Evan Smith, came at her with. So real impressive stuff there from Vieira, and that was the reason why, even though I picked against her, I said I'm not confident I'm staying away, because the fight-to-fight improvements from Vieira, and she showed it. Maybe in spades is a bit strong, but I was impressed. I was impressed. So, yeah, that wraps up this. I think I got some food on the way here, hopefully. Yeah, it's going to be a good rest of the Sunday as I continue on with my outline and dive deeper into the breakdown for next week, UFC Nashville. So, yeah, stay tuned for that. I'm going to have that up, a Mixed Martial Analyst. We'll do another breakdown here, of course, on the Protect Your Neck podcast. Continue to follow the podcast at the PYN podcast. Follow me at the MM Analyst. And until then, watch the body shots, don't underestimate your opponent, and protect your neck.